This week we're talking about community in America. Yesterday we began by talking about the ways that Americans conceptualize individuals in community. I suggested that the political personalism of the 60s offered a different way of looking at the issue, one that anticipated the communitarianism of the 90s. Today I'd like you to invite us to think and talk about work and community in America and the ways in which we might work for community. I'd like to begin by looking at the spirit of the 60s and its cogent critique of work. Then I'd like to look at some contemporary thinking about work and community and think about the ways that a personalist approach to work, one that took the person as the primary value of the system, might enhance our lives. The 60s, as you know, were a crazy time. Activists were especially crazy in all sorts of ways, but they weren't crazy in the ways that most Americans were. And that's the almost pathological craziness that said, in the face of lots of evidence, that everything was okay and there was no need for activism. Against this kind of cultural passivism, spelled in that way, P-A-S-S-I-V-I-S-M, young people growing up in America confronted cultural expectations of work and love. Parents and other adults told them that they should get an education, get a job, marry, and settle down to raise a family. By the mid-60s, however, young people questioned the cultural presumptions and patterns that dictated such a path for persons. In both word and deed, they began to articulate new visions and versions of work and community. The counterculture, like the new left, rejected the labor union focus of the old left, but it maintained an interest in work and workers. Counterculturalists challenged the modern work ethic because work had become impersonal, instrumental, and alienating. They criticized a system based on compulsory work compensated by compulsive consumption. During the course of the 20th century, America's workers and employers had embraced what some historians called the Great Compromise, whereby laborers, in effect, agreed to do meaningless work for high wages that could purchase private satisfactions. This system of deferred gratification was good for the economy because it created an alternating current of production and consumption. In post-war American culture, too, the work ethic had been complemented by a fun morality. On payday, the payoff was leisure, the socially constructed consumption of what we quaintly call free time, as opposed, I presume, to the slave time of work. The consumption of free time in hobbies, sports, and leisure, which get increasingly commodified all through the period after World War II, so that it's real hard to do anything now without having to buy something in order to do it. Sometimes even to buy a particular set of shoes to do whatever activity it is that you're involved in. After the work week came the weekend, the paradise of private pleasures, and as compensation for 50 weeks of labor, there was 2 weeks of vacation. In mainstream American culture, utilitarian individualism that we talked about last time combined with the work ethic to create a culture of competition. Individuals, especially men, in search of social mobility, competed with each other for the scarce rewards of alienating work. Sports and education taught people that competition was natural and inevitable. Rewarding the winners, society stigmatized the losers. At the same time, the American work ethic complicated issues of identity for America's young people, who found that in a mainstream American America, you are what you do. You know, when people come up to me at a party or something like that and ask, what do you do? Usually you have to say you're a college professor. You can't say, well, I'm a gardener, or I'm a hot rod racer or something like that. What they want to know is what you do for money. Well, and that's where identity mostly comes from. This system of alternating work and leisure also seemed suspect to many 60s activists. Work seemed alienating, not sufficient for whole persons. In their own variation of the here and now revolution, the hippies, for example, said, why wait? Why not take pleasure in the here and now? The pleasures of American middle-class adulthood seemed tepid to many hippies who wanted more intensity and passion in their pleasures. Arguing that gratification deferred was too often gratification deterred, the counterculture celebrated the centrality of play, which is not the same thing as leisure. Immediate and enjoyable, superfluous and unnecessary, playfulness, and that literally they meant that, playfulness, undermined the dichotomies of the work ethic. For the now generation, the pleasures of the present took precedence over the promises of the future. This politics of pleasure, which played almost no role in the partisan politics of the 60s, you don't see Lyndon Johnson at any point saying, I'm for the politics of pleasure, pitted the hippie pursuit of happiness against the so-called Puritan practices of the mainstream culture. Counterculturalists assumed that genuine affluence, which they'd been told was around ever since the 1950s, could transform an American culture still premised on scarcity. While mainstream culture assumed that affluence would allow more consumption, however, the counterculture doubted that fulfillment could come from increased consumption. Hippies were willing to exchange the American affluence of people who owned much for the Zen affluence of people who wanted little. Rejecting the suburban ideal of people of plenty, they expected to be fulfilled in lives of voluntary simplicity. In an age of affluence, hippies thought, people didn't need to work for money. They needed to work for community, for personal fulfillment, for reconciliation with the earth. In recounting the history of the farm commune, Stephen Gaskin referred to the group's work as right vocation. We feel that work is the material expression of love, he said, and that love is not an abstract idea or something for a bumper sticker, but that if you really do love somebody, you could find it in your heart to get off your tail for them. At its best, the countercultural critique of the work ethic resulted in good work. Like earlier anti-modern reformers, many counterculturalists turned to the arts and crafts for models of fulfilling labor. Working in the tradition of John Ruskin and William Morris, even when they didn't know it, they counterpoised the personalism of a handicraft society with the impersonality of the manufacturing and manufactured world. They emphasized home production of necessities and of the artifacts that made life beautiful. Unlike their parents who lived in prefabricated housing and gloried in the products of the department store or the supermarket, the young dissidents preferred to craft their own clothes and their own meals. At its worst, however, the countercultural criticism of work led to the abandonment of both the work ethic and an ethic of service. Like the amiable beatnik Maynard G. Krebs in The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, some counterculturalists avoided both work and its intrinsic satisfactions. Living lives of comparative leisure, they found that the conventions of leisure in American society, formed as they were as a counterpoint to alienating work, were not sustainably satisfying either. In the long run, the hippies' non-existent work habits undermined many of their utopian ideals. The 60s critique of work addressed many important questions, but because they didn't control the workplaces of America, their ideas were seldom employed in the cultural mainstream. 30 years later, however, there is more interest in these issues, in part because work has changed substantially since the 60s. In the 1990s especially, several sociologists have returned to this problem identified in the 60s. Many of these authors speak to the issue of what we might call the poverty of work. Some people are poor because they're unemployed. Some of the rest of us are poor because we are employed in such stupid jobs. And still others are poor because we are employed in good jobs that demand more time than is good for us as human beings. In her 1992 book, The Overworked American, Juliet Shore contended that many of us are working more than is good for us. Between 1967 and 1987, the average number of hours of paid work increased almost 10%, from 1,786 hours to 1,949 hours a year. That's about an extra month of work added on in 20 years. And with the downsizing and right-sizing of the last 10 years, things haven't gotten better. Some of us are workaholics who need a swig of work to stay sane, but most of us are more abducted by work than addicted to it. We work because we want to, but we work long hours because we have to. Work expands to fill the time available, and all the other time, too. Like Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone, America's Declining Social Capital, Shore contended that the conditions of contemporary work were affecting contemporary communities by sucking up what he calls, the social capital that could have been generated in other settings. Time at work is time not spent in other places, the home, the neighborhood, the city council meeting, the voluntary organization, where important work needs to be done. And Arlie Hochschild, in this new book, The Time Bind, finds very much the same thing. In fact, she finds some very interesting things in there, because at one point, people who were sort of thinking about the overworked Americans said, well, give Americans opportunities to work less. Give them part-time options and flex-time options and job-sharing options, and then we'll have a situation where people can get involved in some other sorts of things. And what Hochschild found is that many companies said, yeah, good idea, we'll do that. Here's a policy. We think that we ought to offer our employees opportunities to do this. And what Hochschild finds in this book is that nobody took them. People have insisted on working long hours, And one of the most interesting things that she finds is that the reason that many people want to work long hours is that home has become transformed in our minds into a workplace. So that we're having this kind of reversal. So with human resources things at companies now, you can often get more social support and more human support at work than you can at home. You can get an award for being a good worker. I'm a distinguished teaching professor at St. Olaf, but who gives an award for being a good father? Every once in a while it happens, you know, maybe there's a father of the year in the state of Minnesota or something like that, but most of us have more opportunities really for reward and social support in our workplaces than we do at home. And Hochstadt finds that this is really causing some tremendous problems because people are spending more and more time out of the home. She interviews lots of people, and there's one couple in there where both of them are working about 60 to 70 hours a week. Mm-hmm. And the reason that they're doing that is that neither one of them wants to stay home. And particularly for the man presumes he doesn't have to be home. So he just figures that he works a lot, and then when he gets home, he can go fishing. And her way of forcing him back into the home is to go to work, because then he feels compelled to come back. Nothing else that she can do will get him to do that. So in many ways, the amount of work that we're doing is part of a politics of home. That's a very pervasive part of what's going on. So essentially what she says is that changed policies at work are not enough. What we really need is a changed culture of work. And she says right now... change the policies at home, too. But she's really focusing on work and saying that at work what you need is different ways of evaluating what quality is. Most of the time, quality is associated with quantity, and so people assume that unless you're putting in the hours, you can't be really serious or you can't be really committed to the company. And so long hours are generally a part of company culture, even of companies that have policies that are, quote, family friendly. I'll come back to this in a little bit. Today we might want to think about what makes good work and not just a good job. For most Americans, a good job is one that satisfies the self and pays for the privatism of family life. But what are the characteristics of really good work? What are the characteristics of work that we love? To love any sort of work, writes Scott Russell Sanders in this book, Rooted in the Land, it may seem an odd emotion in a country where bumper stickers proclaim that work is a four-letter word. In her book, To Work and to Love, Dorothy Zoella offers a way of framing work issues within our religious traditions. Zoella suggests that good work includes three things: self-expression, social relatedness, and reconciliation with nature. I would call this vision personalist. So first of all, let's think about work as self-expression. When we think about work as self-expression, we ask, what does this work do to and for the worker? When we think of work as part of the essential self, or something that people need to do as to be a self, work is an opportunity to use one's gifts and talents to the fullest and for the best ends. And what we are concerned with is the effect of work on the worker. Does it enhance one's gifts or skills? Does it make the person better instead of just better off? Good work should have intrinsic satisfactions, and it should make the worker more human and humane. As Dorothy Zoella says, we must not settle for less than work that is good for the worker. And too often, I think, though, in the name of efficiency or in the name of what we would call the Great Compromise, we do exactly that. We settle for work that is really not very good for the worker at all. In their book, Loving and Working, Reweaving Women's Public and Private Lives, did you just want to say something?
I wanted to backtrack a minute on your last couple sentences in that last paragraph.
Okay.
And if you could just read them again in terms of the good work and what, again, what she said was good work. The last couple sentences of that last paragraph.
Okay. Does work enhance one's gifts or skills? Does it make the person better instead of just better off? Good work should have intrinsic satisfactions, and it should make the worker more human and humane. As Dorothy Zoella says, we must not settle for less than work that is good for the worker. Too often, I think, in the name of efficiency or in the name of the Great Compromise, we do. In their book, Loving and Working, Reweaving Women's Private and Public Lives, Rosemary Barciascus and Deborah Hull suggest that work is not primarily a thing one does to live, but the thing one lives to do. It is, or should be, the full expression of the worker's faculties, the thing which she finds spiritual, mental, and bodily satisfaction, and the medium in which she offers herself to God. We should no longer think of work as something that we hasten to get through in order to enjoy our leisure. We should look on our leisure as the period of changed rhythm that refreshed us for the delightful purpose of getting on with our work. And within a religious tradition, this is exactly what Sabbath is supposed to do. You know, we're supposed to be working for the kingdom of God, and Sabbath is a time when we take off, we rest up, and we think about it. In modern American culture, Sunday is the time that you take off and go to the mall. In this view, good work should be God's work, allowing persons to delight in the exercise of their co-creative gifts. As Scott Russell Sanders suggests, it should allow us to practice our faith. The old theological debate as to whether salvation is to be gained by works or by faith comes from a false dichotomy. Faith concerns our sense of what is real, what is valuable, what is holy. Work is how we act out that faith. One feels that for the Shaker craftsman, Thomas Merton observed, love of God and love of truth in one's own work came to the same thing, and that work itself was a prayer, a communion with the inmost spiritual reality of things, and so with God. So that's work as self-expression. But knowing how work is good for us individually, however, doesn't necessarily place us in community. And so Suella's second point is that work needs to enhance our social relatedness, our solidarity with the community. And when we're thinking about it this way, we need to ask ourselves, how does this work relate the person to the community? What in the world is this work good for? What good is this work for the world, including the second and the third world? This, I think, involves several things. At the workplace, I suspect, it means working with others for a common good, maintaining a conversation about the quality of the practices that we pursue. Work should be shared and interpersonal, requiring whole persons, or at least a reasonable facsimile of them, to interact. I don't mean that we need to be permanently in other people's presence to be in conversation. I know that as a writer, I need to work alone. But even when I'm working alone, I am part of a larger conversation because I anticipate my words being read or said in places like this. In good work, Zoella says, we participate in the flow of teaching and learning, of making our contributions and receiving the contributions of others, of being needed and having our needs met. We become a part of what we might call the gift economy, the moral economy that calls us to exchange our gifts for the gifts that others have to give. In his essay on the complexities of bread baking in Rooted in the Land, Scott Russell Sanders connects the gift economy to community, noting that the words community, communion, and communicate all derive from common, and the two syllables of common derive from separate roots, the first meaning together or next to, and the second having to do with barter and exchange. Embodied in that word is a sense of our shared life as one of giving and receiving. Music, touch, ideas, recipes, stories, medicine, tools, the whole range of artifacts and talents. After 25 years with Ruth, his wife, that is how I have come to understand marriage, as a constant exchange of labor and love. In this formulation, the work we give should be a return for the work we receive. And if we think about it that way, we need to think about work not just as the gift that we give, but as a gift that we constantly receive, because the spirit in which we receive the gift sometimes affects the way the work is done. Recently, for example, when I finished my book, The Spirit of the 60s, I sent copies to people whose work had especially influenced mine, and one of them was a sociologist on the East Coast. And I wrote a note along with the book in saying what their work meant to me. Every single person that I sent a copy of the book to responded just enthusiastically, because apparently this doesn't get done very often. The sociologist on the East Coast said that although her work had been professionally reviewed and reviewed favorably, my letter was the first time she had ever received a personal thanks for her thinking. Her letter made me think. What kind of work culture creates a situation in which we hesitate to praise good work? And hers was good work. We also need to think about the distribution of work in the community if we're thinking about social relatedness. Some work, suggests Wendell Berry, is so essential to the community or so difficult and distasteful that we all should share in it. Indeed, like dish team and garbology at Holden, the more broadly it should be shared, the harder the work, the more broadly it should be shared, and the more it should be done cooperatively. And Jim, of course, would agree with that, having been there this morning. Work also needs its practices of commitment. Instead of always looking for labor-saving devices, it's important that we look for devices for maintaining good labor and a kind of sociability in the workplace that makes it human. And here the Amish may be an example. The Amish decline to use some kinds of technology, not because they have any kind of objection to it at all, but because it would take them away from social situations where a lot of them have to get together now to do that particular bit of work. And if they had a machine to do that kind of work, they would lose the kind of human contact that comes from doing it together. Now, in most of our workplaces, the water cooler and the coffee break are where some of this interaction happens. But for me, that's not enough, because those things happen in the breaks of the work. Lunch can be a practice of commitment. At St. Olaf, for example, we started a series of lunches for talking about teaching. And that's a little bit closer, I think, but lunch is still probably not enough. I think we need on the job ways to think about and practice the broader goals of our work in the world. And that means, I think, that we need more time on the job to think about what is it that we're doing anyway in really the big picture of God's creation and God's work. Two, I think that good work means making something or doing something that's genuinely good for people. It's not enough not to be harmful. I'm not sure that all of the things that Americans get paid for qualify in this regard. We seem to have lots of work that is good for people who own workplaces, but less work that's good for the people in those workplaces or for the people served by those workplaces. We seem to have more work that is good for us financially than personally or spiritually. The economy alone doesn't help us very much in this regard. That's why the concept of moral economy is so important. And it's a concept used by historians to describe the ways in which over time, almost every society has had ways in which they've put moral limits on the way that work would be done in the world. And those moral limits, in a way, fall away as you move into a more purely market kind of transaction, where you think that everything is a kind of measure of efficiency and that the market and money can handle all of the transactions. Although there is an implicit value in that, too, and that's that everybody decides separately what's good for the world, and that the sum of all individual transactions is the common good, which I have my doubts about. Still, we need to think about the financial implications of our work. Who profits from our work? What societal institutions are stronger for our working and which are weaker? What are the opportunity costs of work? What do we give up when we go? Do the profits of our work produce patterns of belief and behavior that we want featured in the future? Conversely, we also need to think about who's hurt by our work. Few people are hurt directly. I mean, I can't think of very many of us in occupations where you're actually hurting somebody in the occupation, unless you're Mike Tyson, say, biting off someone's ear. But many of us participate in work that structurally, at least, privileges some groups and not others. Who gains and who loses by the patterns of work we participate in? Finally, and that's sort of work as social solidarity. Finally, Dorothy Zuellis thinks that good work is part of our reconciliation with the community of nature. We need to ask, what good is this work for the natural world? How does this work advance the work of creation? How does it replenish the earth? Good work should be a healing art, making things in creation whole. Again, I think that most work in America fails to meet this standard because too often we are engaged in practices that are destructive of the earth, generally out of our sight and out of our mind. It's not that we don't need work that's good for nature, we need lots of it. In the coming 20 years, we need to think about how all our jobs can be reconfigured to help us as co-creators of God's creation. This is something I'll talk about a little bit more tomorrow. Now, culturally in America, we have socially constructed work as something that, in general, we say we don't like, even though we spend a lot of time in doing it. We say, for example, we have songs, take this job and shove it. We say, thank God it's Friday. There's no comparable saying for Monday. We often say, I have to go to work. We very seldom say, I get to go to work. These are the sort of cultural constructions, just the kind of language that we use that gives us some indication of at least socially how we're supposed to think about work. Some of us use these constructions even though we feel like we do get to go to work. We will still say, in a social situation, we have to go to work. But we need a way of thinking about work that avoids the negative connotations that we have socially constructed. In America, most of us are happy to have a job, which is a position for which we get paid. A job is a piece of work, if you look it up. In fact, in the 19th century, the term job work meant piecework. The word job comes from a Middle English word meaning lump, which I really like, and is related to our word gob. in the 18th century, Samuel Johnson defined a job as petty, piddling work. And for many of us, the definition still fits. A job is work, but it's not necessarily good work. Better than a job for most Americans is a career, which is the upward trajectory of jobs over time. A career is primarily private. It is a single person's advancement within social boundaries, and it often leads to social and geographical mobility and the uprooting of communities. A career culture requires ambitious, calculating individualists who want to get ahead, leaving the rest of us, by definition, behind. But a richer conception than job or career is the old idea of vocation, a calling from God to help create the kingdom of God on earth. Vocation gives us a way of thinking about the cosmic and communitarian aspects of work, and it invites us to think about the gift of creation and the creation of our gifts, and the ways in which our gifts might be applied to the purposes of the creation. A vocation is a call from God to use God's gifts for her glory and for the good of the community, including the poor. A calling can never be purely private. It's simply not done. I mean, God calls you to work in community. Nor can it be purely vocational in the narrow sense of the word. A vocation is God's call to work in the world, not just at work, but in all the settings of our lives. If we believe in vocation, we are all at work now, because we are all engaged in thinking about our work in the world. In his book, Earth in Mind, David Orr also thinks of work within such traditions. In writing about the dangers of education, he's also a college professor, Orr suggests that the primary danger of American education is that it will encourage young people to find careers before they find a calling. A career, Orr says, is a job, a way to earn one's keep, a way to build a long resume, a ticket to somewhere else. For upwardly mobile professionals, a career is too often a way to support a lifestyle by which one takes back more than one gives. Where one takes more than one gives back. In contrast, a calling has to do with one's larger purpose, personhood, deepest values, and the gift one wishes to give the world. A calling is about the uses one makes of a career. A career is about specific aptitudes. A calling is about purpose. A career is planned with the help of career development specialists. A calling comes out of an inner conversation. A career can be found in a calling, but a calling cannot easily be found in a career. Perhaps, therefore, instead of saying that we are at work or on vacation, we should say that we are on vocation. Now, I'm going to talk just a little bit about changing work. There are, of course, individual methods of coping with the poverty of work in America, and many of us have adjusted to the maladjustments of the workplace. But even though individualism teaches us that individuals have to adapt to business practices, personalism and communitarianism would teach us differently. There is also a potential politics of work. Still, we don't have very much of it. Although it is clear that work is a social construction with important political implications, for the most part, in this country, we have decided to let people with money decide how to structure work. If you think about the last presidential campaign, almost nothing said about work. A lot is said about jobs. Can we create more jobs? But nothing said about the quality of the jobs or the kinds of work that they might be interested in. There are a few laws that regulate minimum wage and maximum hours and the safety of the workplace. But for the most part, employers are free to shape work in any way that meets their needs, most notably their needs for stability and profit. But since work is political, and because work is part of the politics of meaning, we might also decide to speak as citizens to help shape a society in which good work was more the rule than the exception. Or to go back to the phrase that I used the other day, we might think about a way to make it easier for people to be good. We might think about it a way to make it easier for employers to give good work. We might begin to embrace a politics that made work instead of jobs a central issue. This might mean moving to what Charles Durber calls the social market, an economic system that encourages worker ownership and participation and that maximizes public participation in economic decision making. Both employee ownership and employee stock option programs already give workers a voice in the work of their workplaces and allows them to accept lower profits if they want to cut the social costs of business, say pollution, the loss of jobs, and other community problems. Work management teams at work allow workers to bring their human skills of creativity and collaboration to the work at hand. So this is probably not entirely un-American to do this. General Motors has embraced it. The Saturn plant in Spring Hill, Tennessee, says Derber, vests employees with a version of lifetime employment and empowers workers to co-manage and share decision-making power from top to bottom of the company, while also making a commitment to quality, which gives employees a sense of responsibility to customers. Here are some additional possibilities for a politics of work and community, gleaned from a lot of the sociologists that I've been reading. First, a reduced workload, say 35 hours a week, with double time after 35 hours. With a reduced weekly load, we could also think about mandatory vacation or sabbatical, which some countries have. The United States has the shortest vacation time of any industrial country in the world. And it could well turn out that less work is in fact more vocation, because it may be that if we only work 35 hours a week at the place that we now call work, we would do work in our communities, at the PTA, volunteering at schools, those kinds of things. So less work could be more vocation. Second, we could think about creating the jobs we really need, either in the public or the private sector. For example, we need jobs that would design and manufacture things for permanence. We need more people who can do repairs of things instead of just throwing out an appliance as soon as we find that it doesn't work in exactly the way that it was supposed to. We need a lot of people to get involved in conservation, including retrofitting houses. We need a lot of people for environmental cleanup and restoration. We need people to think about new kinds of railroads, mass transit, methods of moving us where we want to go without cars. We need people to design pocket suburbs and urban villages, one of the places that we might want to go to in these new forms of transportation. And I'll talk about them some on Saturday. We need people to be involved in worship, ritual, the arts, education, all of which are jobs that are environmentally safe and fulfilling, what we might call post-materialist work. Third, we might think about time shifting, especially to accommodate families. So we might think about having more part-time, more flex time, more job sharing, more home work. We might think about on-site childcare or generous family leave policy that would allow everybody to participate in public life. At our companies, we might think about paid pro bono work. The legal profession does this sometimes already, to make sure that our skills can be given directly to those most in need of community. We might think about changed corporate incentives. For example, in this Arlie Hochschild's book here, she suggests that the companies that now win the Department of Commerce's, I think it's the Commerce Department gives the Malcolm Baldrige Award, which is sort of the top award for outstanding performance in meeting the standards of total quality. But it mainly focuses on companies that are efficient at doing what they are. So she says, instead of asking how many man hours did we put into this project, the question of total quality becomes, is the customer pleased? It would not seem so odd then to urge companies to measure success in work-family balance by outcomes at home. How many working parents at a given company report that they have time for their families? This could be part of the Malcolm Baldrige Awards. How many go to PTA meetings? How many volunteer in the schools? There could be signs of a these could be signs of a company's success in establishing work-family balance. This is simply a different kind of accounting. What is it that we will pay attention to and report to each other? Another thing that we might think about would be full life cycle accounting taxes. This is something that David Orr and a lot of other people in environmental studies talk about, to figure all the costs from extraction to disposal into the price we see on merchandise. This would mean additional jobs taking care of things like pollution and community unsettlement that are now considered externalities that don't figure into the price of things that we now pay for. Or last but not least, and almost heretically, we might think about higher marginal taxes on incomes. By the standards of the developed world, American tax rates are relatively low, encouraging Americans to stay at work and earn more money. If we put higher taxes on the higher levels of income, maybe people would go home and do more productive things. But changing work would be more than a political process. It would also be a cultural project, and that's what Hochschild has talked a lot about, because so many of our assumptions and institutions are shaped by deep-seated cultural values, values which may, in this setting, be dysfunctional. We might think about changing cultural patterns of the job so that we're paying more attention to persons on the job than to the productivity that comes out of it. We also might need to think about changing things at home, because housework is work, and it has a lot to do with the way that we do work in the workplace. In the 1980s, employed women put in more time working than either employed men or technically unemployed housewives, an average of 76 hours a week. Although a greater number of men say that they should share housework recently, and men are in fact doing more housework, the shares are by no means equal, and much of men's housework is, quote, helping out, which assumes that the responsibility for the home is still the woman's. And you see this in some of the language that we use also. Men will sometimes refer to staying with their children as babysitting, which is real hard to imagine since they're not getting paid for it, like babysitters are, and since, for God's sake, they are their children. Or they refer to themselves, if they stay home, as Mr. Mom, which suggests that the role is really mom's role and not a parent's role to be taking care of children. Ellen Goodman wrote a wonderful essay years and years ago now, called A Grateful Housewife Has Second Thoughts, in which she said basically that she knew about a housewife who was grateful that her husband helped out, and then the housewife had second thoughts and thought, you know, really, this is helping out is not the whole deal. Having it in your mind is a really important part of what goes on, and the husband ought to be having in mind what the work of the household was as much as the housewife did. And so she wrote this in there and got more reaction to that column than to any other column that she ever wrote. But this kind of change in housework, this kind of balancing of housework, might mean a kind of integrative feminism or maternal thinking for both sexes. If men were emotionally and practically committed to childcare, says Sarah Luddick, the author of Maternal Thinking, they would reform the work world in parents' interests. To conclude today, we might look at the spirituality of work questionnaire that comes from Matthew Fox's The Reinvention of Work. He asks us several questions that locate our working community. And I'll list those questions, not all of them are. Number 2, do others experience joy as a result of my work? Number 8, how does my work connect to the great work of the universe? Number 9, how is my work a blessing to generations to come? Number 13, who profits from my work? Number 15, what allies have I made within the work world? Number 16, what enemies have I made because of my work? Number 17, how does my work affect the environment? Number 22, if I were to leave my work today, what difference would it make? Number 24, what ways of doing Sabbath, of resting and letting go of work, do I engage in? And number 30, what is sacred about the work I do? Asking and answering questions like these, we might begin to think and act as if work were a genuine vocation, a response to God's call, and a response to the injunction in Genesis to be fruitful and replenish the earth. That would be work worth working for. So, have any of you ever done any work? Do you have questions or comments?
We were all, I think, in listening, I was made the assumption that we're talking about work for which you get paid. But there are a large segment of people who may no longer be doing work for which they get paid, but are perhaps doing more work in the community, and they may have the same characteristics of not being personally rewarding, all those things. It can occur to people who work as volunteers, positive and negative, as well as who get paid positively.
Right, I think you're right. That in a way, one of the things that we need to do is, when we think about vocation, is to realize that vocation includes both paid and unpaid work. And that even for people who are doing paid work for a lot of their time, the unpaid, there are other things that they're supposed to be doing as part of vocation.
I teach at a prep school, which it has a large tuition, and your comments about the idea of directed educational progress toward a job are painful. Rather than training one's mind, it's a specific undergraduate school with a specific major in mind, far too early. Far too limiting, and far too unspiritually based. And it just ravages my soul to listen to the kids talk about how much the income base will be if I have this much training, or their parents who have, and this is a really serious problem among suburban upper middle class parents who are investing a specific amount of money with a specific return. And we're talking about children. We're talking about beings, and we're not talking about commodities. And just amen to that. It's just, what you're saying is reflected in my daily experience almost every day.
Right. Even at St. Olaf, where we are working within a religious tradition that allows us to think about vocation, those pressures are very strongly felt. I'm in American Studies, which students in general think is not a very productive major, and I'm also in history, which they think is even less productive than that. So what I often find is I have students who are double majors. They do one major for their parents, which is the productive, more business-oriented math, science, econ major, and then they do American Studies or something like that for themselves, for what really satisfies them. And I applaud them for that. It's unfortunate that they have to make that choice, I think, at some time. And yet, a part of what we do want to do in education is to prepare people to do good work in the world. That's different than the particular career tracks that they have in mind, which have to do largely with incomes.
Can I follow that? It took me a decade to get a community service program in our school. It's now mandatory. And the first and most resistant possibility or part of that was the parents are saying, I'm paying $10,000. This seems to be extraneous from what we're asking the school to do. No, I'm quite serious about this. We had a whole decade in which we had boards of trustees and various people who fought that kind of thing based on some of that kind of logic. Not entirely, but there was a great deal of resistance to that.
Yeah.
You're taking away time from what's
important
in education or whatever. Thank you.
Yeah, and what would be interesting is if we had a workplace in which service was a regular part of a person's job, then the service component of an education at a prep school would
sure.
be, oh yeah, I need to do that because I need to be ready to do that when I'm working
you,
in the quote.
In our area does that. They expect their people to do community service.
More and more high schools particularly are.
Well, this
are,
is a company.
Hewlett
Packard is a company, corporation.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Cummins, right.
Corporate.
Oh, yeah, they're terrific.
And they expect community service
right.
from their employees.
And again, you know, there are professional models for that. Many law firms do that simply as a matter of course, and people work in legal aid or something like that.
I guess it used to be that we could go to school and learn things for education. And is that just a fact that we are a product of the 50s, education, Don and I, and at that time, there were jobs. You really could choose to say that education was for my edification and I could always go out and get a job. And maybe, and this seems to be the change that I've heard a lot about in my children and so on, is that there's so few, that the job thing is so much more tenuous now. So education is getting used this way more, or the tension in the parents, I don't know. But
I think the perception is clearly that it's very hard to get good jobs, and that perception I think is accurate if you think about entry level jobs. It's very hard for people to come out of a liberal arts college like St. Olaf with a really fantastic entry level job. But you know, on the other hand, they have 50 years to work their way up to a fantastic job. They have time for that, and there are an awful lot of students at a college like St. Olaf. Who are there just to learn as broadly as they possibly can, and they can just be gems. And when you meet their parents at graduation or on, you know, a parents' weekend or something like that, you would just want to congratulate them for that. So that it's still possible to be that way. I think right now, actually, the job market is getting pretty good, particularly in Minnesota. The job market is really really quite good. So I think that it may be that the fears will diminish a little bit. Although I think it's in many people's interest to keep those fears up.
You know, that's the irony. You talk about the job market is good, but when you were talking about reducing the work week and increasing vacation, we're so caught in the global economy, and everything I hear suggests that one of the reasons why this country is supposedly doing so well is because we haven't been generous. I don't know to the extent that's true, but to the extent it's true, there is within a global economy, there's kind of a price to pay as you become more generous to workers in terms of competing with other countries.
Yeah, it depends. I think there's a price to pay if you don't tell people what the real costs of everything are. The company that I keep coming back to in this regard is Ben & Jerry's. Ben & Jerry's has a corporate policy that doesn't, and also environmentally, that are very positive. And because they've let people know that, people buy that ice cream. And I think that more and more companies need to do that. And the competition among companies needs not to just be on sort of price efficiencies. Can I get my thing down to 19 cents when the competitor has 20 cents? But an explanation of why my price might be 22 cents while the competitor's is 20 cents. And I think that, I'll say even the Kathy Lee Gifford thing that happened last year is an indication that if people were informed, and again, you could do this very easily simply by saying that the Congress will require full cost accounting on a tag, on a garment, so that shoes, for example, you'd have to say what factory it was produced in, what percentage of the minimum wage in that particular country the people were making, what kind of benefits were provided to those workers. It would make for large tags, you know. And it'd be great for the paper industry, I suppose. But it would be a way of providing the kind of information that that is actually there in the product, that those products are all produced in particular ways in particular places, some of them more or less detrimental to people and places. And I think that the more that people knew about that, the more they would likely be to respond to it. But right now we don't have any regulation that says you have to do that. Let's see, I have a question in the back here, and then I'll come to you.
Observations. I'm not sure how many Lutherans read Luther, but you know, he has a lot to say about Christian vocations. You ought to read him sometime on Christian vocations. This kind of about 400 years ago he was saying these things, and the sacredness of work. And I'm not sure whether the library here has Luther's complete works, but if it does, you ought to read what he has to say about this. He was sort of adamant about this.
Right. I mean, these are new works in sociology that I'm talking about, but these are not new ideas.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of what I'm doing this week is talking about what I would call neo-traditionalism.
And the other you mentioned, so that you know, that in our in the Rotary Club that I belong to, we have a company, or a representative of a company, that I think is like Ben and Jerry's. It's the Outback Steakhouse. I'm not sure where they are in the United States, but I know that they have units in Denver and around in Colorado. But our local manager belongs to our club, and he's constantly winning awards for his social consciousness, his employee morale, his community contributions from one steakhouse restaurant in Denver. And I guess we're always talking to him after meetings and finding out what he's doing next by way of carrying out some of the things that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, good examples are awfully persuasive. Much better to have a good example like that than to have a college professor like me talking about these things.
Well, what a college professor.
There's a very prominent businessman in Minneapolis who had a father who was a pretty astute businessman himself. And when he was quite young, in his teens, I think, his father said to him, he said, you will be spending 25% of your time in volunteer work. And he made sure that this came true, and that really made the businessman. It made him, literally made him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful experience for kids to get involved in volunteer work. I mean, my kids are very much caught up in what I would call fun morality, you know, that you have a moral obligation to be doing things that are fun, which generally means buying something that has been produced by the leisure industry. And so often when we are, as a family, going to get engaged in a kind of service work, they're resistant to doing it. But afterwards, they're always very pleased that they have done it. And I think they experience a kind of pleasure that they can't experience within the fun morality. And you probably have that experience also with your students.
Our kids resist the idea of community service and the sense of satisfaction after it's done. You know, why do I have to do this? Why is this required? Oh, this, you know, and there's several words that I won't use, but they really do have an initial resistance, and it's still a great deal of resistance, but if we can take them along enough, that's why we made it required.
Yeah.
It's because we found it beneficial for them in the long term.
I was thinking about a column I read by Ellen Goodman a couple of years ago, probably several years ago, where she was reacting to our language of community and how in the popular press for example, you'll hear community defined by the workplace and not by the neighborhood. You have the blue-collar community, the medical community, legal community, educational communities, healthcare community.
Right.
All defined in terms of where people work. And I was just, underneath that is a question, how did we get there when other industrialized nations seem not to have? We had an intern in our parish from Germany a few years ago, they just had a baby. And they were shocked and offended at how often Kirsten was asked what she was going to do. It would not occur to them that she would do anything except nurture the child for the first year.
Yeah.
Yeah, a degreed person, but when we had our children, Sue was the only person she knew who was home with young children.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a part of the piece of Ellen Goodman's article, was the loneliness in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Because there was nobody there.
I mean, a lot of that comes out of deeply rooted traditions of individualism and of deeply rooted traditions of privatism as well, which have their benefits. I mean, there are benefits to that. But another part of it is that the federal government after World War II was subsidizing both highway construction and residential housing in the suburbs at a time when they were not financing housing in the cities. They were redlining housing in the cities. And so the money went into that kind of development, that dispersed kind of housing, that is very hard to have a community in places where the housing is dispersed, the streets are 35 feet wide, the traffic can be kind of heavy. That's what I'm going to talk about Saturday, is to some extent, the people who are now designing what are called new urban villages, the neo-traditionalists in architecture and urban planning, who are designing in things that are part of Holden Village, for example. We're in Chalet 1 right now. If you walk by Chalet 1, pay attention to the front porch culture there. It's just, it's remarkable. There's always somebody on that front porch, and they're always talking to each other. What happened in the suburbs after the 1950s is that the front porch went in back, and it became a deck, which meant that it was a privatized, family-ized sort of place. We live in the suburbs, and we do have a front porch, but it's about, 6 feet by 2 feet? Something like that. It's just a quotation of a front porch. It says, think about front porch, but you couldn't possibly use it for anything.
Yeah.
But there's a big deck on the back, which has no steps down, so that presumably you don't want the neighbors to come up. The architecture says a lot.
Barry Levinson's film Avalon says about this transition a great deal, if you've seen that film.
Mm-hmm.
Baltimore and the family, the Italian family that broke up as they moved into the suburbs.
Yeah.
And the suburban cultural. It's a wonderful film. You get a chance to rent it. It's talking right away at this point exactly how that happened within one family.
Who's the person?
It's called Avalon. The director is Barry Levinson.
Mm-hmm. Marvelous.
Yes, it was a great film.
Yeah.
He shows how the family all abandoned the. He shows the half, the dishes and everything else, I guess, at the table, abandoned while they all are in watching television. It was just when the transition came from when television came in, they went in to watch Milton Berle.
Yeah. Actually, one of the things that she says is that the most relaxed time within contemporary families, since she says that families are now becoming Taylorized using sort of efficiency techniques of Frederick Winslow Taylor. You try to do everything as fast as you possibly can so that you have a few slow moments in the family where you can have quality time. So everything becomes faster and faster. But the most relaxing time for families is TV time, where in fact you're not interacting at all. You're just sort of in the same room, maybe watching TV. You've had a question for a long time.
I just wanted to say that, just call attention to the fact that I work in healthcare, and the people that really take care of patients are the ones who are really hurting these days because the workloads are so huge. And pay, my mother's in a nursing home right now, and they can't keep, this is in a small town in Minnesota, in Chisaka City, and they can't keep nurses' aides because they can get more working at Walmart. And this is a very scary thing to me. My mother needs a lot of good care, and they only have one RN in the whole building.
This is where this is where the concept of a moral economy as opposed to a market economy makes a difference, because a moral economy says that you want to put your money where your values are. And you may structure, you may need to structure that publicly. You may need to say that CEOs can't make more than 20 times the amount of the lowest paid worker in a factory. You might want to say that the minimum wage for a teacher will be $40,000 a year or something like that. That we value these people, these kinds of professionals, and therefore we're willing to structure the market in such a way that they get paid.
How can you do that? You
could do that. We do that with you know, minimum wage, maximum hours right now.
How could an individual, where would you start if you want to impact the system like that, besides the polls?
You probably start, Juliet Shore has a group working out of Harvard to try to pass laws that would allow for, I'm not sure that it would be things exactly like that, but the back of Juliet Shore's book has a place to write, to start thinking about work issues.
I was very interested through all of your presentation in terms of sliding over some of the business companies and the economy and the way things are done, and now we're up against the moral values. Now my question to you is, who will decide? The intellectual elite? The politicians? You were referring a minute ago to Congress. I would be very uneasy about putting morality in the hands of people like that. Who decides? That's sort of my broader question to you.
Well, I think we do more. I mean, we do morality all the time already in all of those places. I think Congress legislates morality every time it passes a law, because it says we will value some things, these things, more than we will value other things. So I think we already have that structured into our system. My hope would be that we would have a wide public participation in this. Although if that didn't work, then I'd vote for college professors, mostly in American studies.
The other thing I hear you advocating for, though, is a deliberate kind of broader awareness. I mean, I see in the culture so much assumption that more profit is better.
Yeah.
And it's not deliberate. It's not thought about. The long-term ecological effect isn't considered.
Yeah, I mean, the people that talk about full cost accounting are the ones that I would really be interested in following along. And I do a lot of this in my classes, and I do a little radio thing on St. Louis radio station where I'm Dr. America, and what I do for that is I give there's the magnificent but wholly imaginary American Studies Museum, which has all of the artifacts of American culture, all of the artifacts ever produced. And each time I just take one artifact and analyze it, and often do the kinds of labor and environmental impacts of things like Pampers, for example, or Nike shoes, for example. And those kinds of these are very short broadcasts, but they're a way of trying to do a full cost accounting, to get people to pay attention to things that they normally don't pay attention to.
Well, in effect, then, all of the miners that were here at Holden Village years ago, were they immoral for what they did with those tailings and everything? And they produced copper that maybe did good things, who knows? But really, we are more moral than they are because we're doing garbology, right?
As a historian, I would say that you have to pay attention to people in the context that they lived in. In the 1930s and 1940s, you would judge people by their own context.
You can't judge them by our morality.
Yeah, I wouldn't judge people by our
morality. Okay, but then when you talk about the morality, who makes the judgment when? That's my question.
Let me answer that in two ways. I think that you can say that collectively we make judgments through our legal institutions. Right now, the people that make the judgments are the people in corporate boardrooms. They make more important judgments about what's good in America than anybody else. That's a very small elite, and we don't elect them at all. So I'd much rather have Congress do it, because at least I get a vote for these people, although lately in Minnesota I've not been doing real well. I think that we can make collective decisions that can impact these things, but I think also privately we make decisions like that, and that's also what I'm advocating, is that if people paid attention to where their products come from, they might not buy one kind of shoe, and they might buy another one. And they might send a letter to the people who produced the shoe that they didn't buy, saying, I think you've got a good product, but I'd be a little happier about buying it if you didn't produce it in Indonesia in the lowest possible wage rates. So I think that each person is responsible for making decisions in both production and consumption.
I work for a German electronics company, and I could talk a long time about the pros and cons of that, but just one thing I want to mention is in terms of the long-term cost accounting, or what was the term you used? The
component? Full cost accounting.
Full cost, yeah. In Europe, they have put in place laws, so the government did this, but where the manufacturer of the product has to take the product back after a certain period of time and recycle it. So that's built in to the laws there, so that you don't have PCs sitting there, with nowhere to go, so to speak, and they're so obsolete nobody wants them.
Right.
But the manufacturer is required to take them back and then recycle the materials in.
It's because they still own them under that system. They own whatever you produce and whatever you manufacture and put out there, you still own, so you're responsible for it.
Yeah, I mean, this would be an example of what up here I have listed as the social economy, where you bring the society into making decisions about the economy. And you need to do it in that way because in a competitive kind of system, unless everybody has to do it, there is a competitive disadvantage of being the one that does it. So legislation is actually very helpful in this regard. A kind of regulation that sets a bottom line can often be very helpful in getting companies and individuals to make it easier for companies and individuals to be good.
Like we did child labor laws how many years ago.
Right.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a little bit more about the question that this gentleman raised here about who decides. For example, the Southern Baptists just decided that the Disney Corporation is an immoral anti-family organization. And what you suggest, the kind of system that you suggest, they're perfectly justified in making such a judgment. In other words, and you would have, obviously, all kinds of moral advocates with competing moralities, if you will, in society. And so at some point, or somebody, people, and does decide, and what you're suggesting is that this would be the federal government, or the legislative body of the government, federal government, to make these kinds of decisions.
I see two different issues. One is externalities, and way, way back when I took economics in college, they said a capitalist system, every company will disregard its externalities because, to make the product cheaper, you don't figure out how much it's going to take to clean up the tailings. You just pull them out and dump them there and run off as soon as you're done. And only a government can put the externalities on a capitalist system so that all the members of the capitalist system play on a level field and all of them have to clean up their externalities. And, that's not really a moral decision, that's purely economic. But then, this kind of thing about, do you like the amount of sex the movie has in it, is something I would think is not going to be a government function. I mean, externalities have to be a government function. Other kinds of values besides externalities.
Seatbelts.
Yeah, seatbelts are a huge externality issue.
And all we have moved to the government so much of what had been many generations ago a community or a family responsibility, and that in itself may be part of what causes us now to have to think about reestablishing community, because we moved it off to the government.
We moved it to the corporate boardrooms. The corporate boardroom would make all these decisions. We even decide who our legislators are, who's in Congress. That's one of the things that we need to change.
We moved it there first in the late 19th century, and then in the 1930s, we moved some functions to government to try to
part of it is because with a larger population and a more complex life, it's a much more interdependent kind of life. You're forced to have to work together and say, okay, we have to cooperate because if we don't, we're all going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on some of the environmental things, and ultimately, that's...
Well, okay, but what about Russia? What about communism? They turned everything over to the government, everybody happy, and they all, you know, it's coming out now that they were getting paid and weren't working hard. I won't go into all that, but that would be the extreme, of course, right? At the extreme.
Yeah, I would think so. I can't imagine that you would ever get our Congress to pass anything remotely like what was...
It was a totalitarian system, though, with an elite group controlling everything.
That's right.
Every aspect. It wasn't a free and open system.
And they put all the decided armaments.
But it will be possible for our country to move in that direction if we keep participating at the low rates that we do in the government. I mean, right now, voter participation in the United States is way down. But again, I think full cost accounting is likely to make people more interested in getting involved in things.
I think one of the things, it comes back to us.
Mm-hmm.
I would say to her how to change that healthcare system. Get on that board. That's what I did in Billings. And they were just going to gut that nursing home with those nurses' aides. And I said, you can't do that. I said, the nursing aides and those nurses are the guts of this institution. It may not look as good on the bottom line, you've got to do something up here, but you know, this is what we're about. And you can only be on the board 6 years, and I talked to the guy that's the head of it, and I says, don't replace me with anybody except a nurse who is Christian, who knows what a nursing home is about. And the same one with Montana Power. You know, we may not like what they do, and I can't get on that board, but I can make enough noise to those people that say, we got to use some social conscience here. And how do you invest your money?
And
do you look at businesses, at investments that have social conscience, or what's
right.
your bottom line?
I absolutely agree with you, and St. Olaf, everything happens in committee.
Yeah.
You want to be on the committees is where you want to be, because that's where that's where the first draft of everything gets written. So you set the agenda for the faculty meeting. We ultimately vote at the faculty meeting, but all the real thinking is done before that. So you want to be on the committees.